Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Late Nights with the Midnight Bomber with Neutron Bomb and Captain B2. Pour it out thick like honey, bittersweet like molasses, seeking your proliferous journey to proffer to the empathetic masses. calling on cathartic release, expel your demons. If but for a moment increase, then cease them, quell their influence, let them not commit treason. Now this week, the focus is on carryovers and cathartic open poetry. You are more than welcome to call in. The number has been posted to the board. Again, it is 657-383-0024. Whilst it is not a prerequisite, we do encourage you to join the Late Night Poets group on allpoetry.com. And Captain, how are you tonight?
I'm splendid. I'm splendid, Neutron. How are you?
Yeah, good. I believe it is just the two of us at the moment. So I am taking the helm in the studio.
Wow.
So let's hope it goes smoothly. Phil, Jean will be somewhere in the background making sure that the episode goes
down
smoothly as she does. That's it. Yeah, I tell you what, it went a lot smoother today.
I'll tell you, you just mentioned something that I'm sitting here working on the prompts right now for our T-shirt wisdom contest, and you just hit on one that would be perfect. I'm going to pull it up here. It says, being a responsible adult every day seems a bit excessive.
It does indeed.
Oh, you're going to love some of the stuff.
Maybe once every 3 days.
Yeah.
And I'll just give you a rundown. We've got a few poems from our contest that I found that hadn't been read yet, or I wasn't 100% sure. So I thought, what the heck, let's read it a second time if that's the case. And then we've got some carryovers from Richard Weissman's show the other day, which focuses on the abstract expressionists. And then we've also got some poems from Pam Ray and Rex's show as well to finish out the day. So it should be a very interesting, dynamic show.
And they long.
Yeah. That's
yeah,
it.
And,
that's it, exactly.
The show before, I think Phil had about 4 or 5 poems left over.
Really? Wow, that's excellent. That's excellent. You never know when you're going to need those. That's the thing, isn't it? So it's. I think it really just depends on the amount of callers and the amount of commentary. So that's definitely the hallmark of a good show when you've got a few left over.
Really? I thought that was the hallmark of a good meal, too. That way you can have leftovers the next day.
Well, with that said, would I be able to get you to read the first one?
Yeah, please. Okay. That's Hall. Sleeping Lion. What a great name. Would you like me to read this?
Certainly.
All righty. We have On Giving Up Hope by Sleeping Lion. And this is from the In My Mind, I Am Free. That was a Stephen Hawking contest. No hope is what I came here for. No hope. I came here to explore this very moment out of time. What's mine is yours. What's yours is mine. We live in hope. We live in fear. We cling to things we hold so dear. But after all is said and done, we are the earth from which we've sprung. We are the earth turned into light. We are the sun turned into light. We are the earth turned into life. We are the sun turned into light. Without the light, where would we be? A man, plant, needs the light to see. And so we live and so we die as life becomes the question. Why? Why are we here? What must we do? Each precious moment, see it through. And when we stop resisting time, when we give up on I, me, mine, this is the way it is, you see. There is no other way to be. When we give up on worldly schemes, when we give up on selfish dreams, the stream of life will take us where there is no darkness or despair. and poem.
Thank you, Bobby. That was a lovely read. I think for me, I was drawn to, and when we stop resisting time, when we give up on I, me, mine, this is the way it is, you see. There is no other way to be. When we give up on worldly schemes, when we give up on selfish dreams, the stream of life will take us where there is no darkness or despair. And I think it was an excellent take on the prompt, which was, my expectations were reduced to zero when I was 21. Everything since then has been a bonus. And I think it was quite a philosophical write, packed to the brim with wisdom. And I don't know if you picked up on it, Bobby, but there was almost a Dr. Seussian vibe to the rhyming scheme employed. And I think it just makes it that much more accessible. And I think poignant. Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
And the only thing I can add to that. Yeah, yeah.
Very rich.
Melodious. I think it was, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And I think it was just simple and pertinently inspirational for the times we find ourselves in currently.
Yes.
And what were your thoughts,
yes,
Bobby?
I agree. I think your observations are quite spot on. It was a very philosophical write. It didn't take any sides except to say that we need to come out of ourselves and to consider life as a whole, and be part of it. You know, it's one thing to be in the world; it's another thing quite to be part of it. And that sounded like what this verse was advocating: being not merely in the world, but part of it. Very, very nicely done.
Yeah, I like, especially at the moment with lockdown, we've got part of Sydney doing the right thing, part of Sydney not doing the right thing. And I think this poem just kind of draws from that. I think it's similar over there in the U.S. at the moment. You've got some states trying to do the right thing and some governors trying to make things very difficult. So,
yeah, people are at odds with it because we've got the two variants. We've got the Delta and the Lambda, Delta being the more prevalent of the two. People have gone back to masking. I know I have. Unfortunately, we're torn between our sense of responsibility and our sense of weariness at having our normal lives upended by all of this. But I saw a news piece today that talked about us being masked and keeping up this vigil until spring of next year.
Oh, that's no good.
Well, it's unfortunately, viruses are living things, and living things take things in their own time. So there's no way to hurry it.
Yeah, well, we had similar advice. They were saying mask wearing potentially for the next few years in Sydney. So you really just set the mercy of the next variant. That's the problem, I think. So
yes, indeed. So,
and we'll move on to the next one.
Something.
we do indeed. We've got a poem by Diana Sorensen, and this was written to as a pre-write, I believe, for the Stephen Hawking contest, just looking at the author notes there.
Yeah.
I'll give it a read. Theogony. God is hidden in the chaos of mathematics. God was spilling out of the teacher's white chalk on my abysmal school blackboard. Extract me a root of Capella's golden citrine light. Did Auriga ever shine on that God-saturated blackboard? Hush, rainforest frogs. Hush, you glistening Ophidian tricksters. We are brewing gods in a pre-Socratic cauldron. Hesiod and Homer told me there must be a god in my paracetamol pill. Ionian sages whisper to me as I gaze at the goat star, because I don't like your gnomon, marking the passage of my days like a Campbell's Soup logo. Erase this horrid red cursive along with cause and effect. I'm flying in a timeless high chariot with Minerva's serpents behind my shield. I'm flying straight into the lodestone of the rising red sun. The prudence of black and white chariot horses returned me into the origin of myself. Gods may live on as skittish goats and capricious clouds aflame with citrine light and calm. Oh, man, I should have got you to read that one, Captain.
That'll teach you.
That'll teach me, all right.
She does a very erudite, very cerebral write. You can tell she is well conversant and very well read in many areas. I mean, she's talking about constellations with Auriga and Capella. She talks about of amphibians and ophidians, which are snakes, by the way. She talks philosophy with Hesiod and Homer. Then she goes to the Campbell soup can, then she goes to Minerva, again, one of the goddesses, the lodestone of the rising red sun, a lodestone being magnetic. This has got a lot of very nuanced passages in it. I think I'm going to tuck this one away in my favorites, because this is one, again, a very cerebral write. I mean, a flame with citrine light. She's got some great visual imagery in here, and it's a very complex write. So you lived through reading it, so I'm proud of you, girl.
Oh gosh, I actually I was drawn to the beginning of it.
And you know, I love reads like this. I love doing them.
I know. I got the order wrong. I should have started off first, I think, and then you should have slipped in for the second one.
Yes.
Drawn.
Got some great.
Yeah.
The gnomon. Gnomon is an instrument for calculating time, like a sundial.
Oh wow!
Got some beautiful references in here.
Yeah, the Greek mythology was a little beyond my grasp of knowledge, but the opening three stanzas I thought resonated. God is hidden in the chaos of mathematics. God was spilling out of the teacher's white chalk on my abyssal school blackboard. Extract me a root of Capella's golden citrine light. Did Auriga ever shine on that God-saturated blackboard? And I think having grown up in the Christian school system and being required to do the compulsory religious studies, our bait with a whiteboard, I just found it really vivid. The concept of God being hidden in mathematics was superb. And I think everything, even science, takes an element of faith. So I thought it was a really good write.
This is a bloody brilliant, right? I mean, Ionian is that was a Greek civilization, but what's really subtle, paracetamol, that is a form of acetaminophen. Now, you want me to tell you what acetaminophen is? You know, I only know it by acetaminophen. I call Advil ibuprofen. And what's the other one? Not Tylenol.
Yeah.
But I think Tylenol might be acetaminophen. But that is subtle. There must be a God in my paracetamol pill, which is a pain reliever. That is such a subtle reference. I mean, really, the whole thing is just one of those pieces that I'm going to have to reread because it is... It is so nuanced and so layered. It is just, I think it's a bloody brilliant write. Oh, she's got or she's got a little bit of a note that, like so many stars that appear single to the eye, Capella actually consists of two stars, Capella A and Capella B, as they're called. They're similar to each other, both roughly 10 times the sun's diameter. They emit about 80 to 50 times more overall light than Sol, respectively. So she did do a little bit of an author's note down there. So I was
fantastic.
Guilty of doing that myself.
I forgot that was there.
Yeah, no, I was guilty of doing that a bit myself in my piece that I read earlier this evening. So that's why I include glossaries with mine now. So now that you, I think you've sufficiently recovered. We got the steam machine here.
If you want to give that one a read, that would be perfect.
Sure, you want me to do this one?
Yeah, I'm definitely sure. I've just opened it.
Okay. You're going to have to call these and earmark them from now on. Big red X on them.
Yeah.
Work in progress by steam machine. Pigmentation dots, scraping plaster, stucco notes, phrases, glazes, lattice, partition, azure wings, abbreviated annotations, ping pong, Buddha threads, white sails, brush strokes, egg splatter, don't matter, polka dots, red ink blots, high notes, low notes, doodle, noodle, treble bass, 52 pickup sticks, fast as she can, white brush, shadow blush, squeeze, cheese, drip drop, ocean motion. Rat-a-tat-tat. She splat orange apples. Adios, amigo. Hello, Dolly. Gold in the pan. File shavings. Twitching hair wood chips. Potato chips. Passport. Good sport. Sailboat. Red eyeliner. Lipstick. Smeared plastic. Green wall. Too tall. Brick paste. Make haste. Gatling gun. Heart attack. Beep, beep. Pink. Blob, doorknob, worn leather saddle. End painting. End poem. And at the end, says an abstract painting. So this was inspired by Richard's last week's contest, the Abstract Expressionists. So that's why it seems like this laundry list of non sequiturs. So that's why it's basically, and it's actually quite clever because you look in and you see, okay, cheese, squeeze cheese, so that there's yellow in there, there's gold, there's red, green. It's got the colors coming through here with all of these abstract shapes, and he's got some great assonance in here too. Blob, doorknob, two brick paste, make haste. Great, great assonance. And he's done it periodically through the whole piece. So he's had fun with it. It's quite a magic.
He has indeed. Now, for the uneducated in the room, which there's only you and me, so it has to be me. Can you just explain assonance for me and the readers just briefly? Is that the internal rhyme?
No. Assonance, there's three tools. There's assonance, consonance, and alliteration. Now, most everyone is familiar with alliteration, which is Peter Piper picked a pack of pickled peppers. Or Sally sells seashells by the seashore, which is the repeat of a consonant. Assonance is a resemblance in sounds of words or syllables, either between the vowels or between the consonants. However, assonance between consonants is called consonance. In poetry, it's the repetition of the sound of a vowel, stressing syllables. Let me see if I can find an example. They said Peter Piper picked a pack of peppers. is assonance also, because it's the repetition of the short E and the long I. Try as I might, I did not fly. And you've got the long I sound in there. The light of the fire is... That's assonance. And alliteration is... I'm going to tell you something you already know, so I won't say that. That's what... it's the same vowel sound repeatedly. Like the bees knees, make me sneeze, that type of thing.
I like the word association in this obstruction. I think, as you mentioned, with the assonance, it did capture the textures and the feel of a chaotic abstract painting. But also I noted that when you read it, it was quite fast-paced, but I think if you had read it faster, it would have been lost on the audience, just because it was making such a great change between the imagery as it went through the poem, but it, not without great cadence. And I stand by my original comment that it was great to hear it read aloud. And I think my favorite part was file shavings, twitching hair, wood chips, potato chips, passport, good sport, sailboat, red eyeliner, lipstick smeared, plastic, green wall, too tall, brick paste, make haste. And I just thought it was an all-round good poem. So the only thing I can add to that is the internal rhyme, you know?
Very nimble. Yeah, it's a very nimble write when you can dance along like that.
Exactly. It's very easy to get tripped up in a poem like that as well, though.
It reads a bit like Lewis Carroll. 'Twas brillig and the slithy toads did gyre and gimble in the wabe. He's not using nonsense words.
One.
Okay.
It is, but somehow it worked. But this one was also submitted for Richard's contest. It's more of a story poem, but definitely a great little read. I'll give this one a go. So it's by Denmark, and it's called The Artist and the Rock. I am a rock and yield to none the swelling words of tiny smooth stone. Neither time nor season can alter me. I am abiding while the ages flee. The pelting hail and the drizzling rain have tried to soften me long in vain. And the tender dew has sought to melt or touch my heart, but it was not felt. There's none that can tell about my birth, for I'm as old as the spinning earth. Generations of man arise and pass out of the world like the blades of grass. And many a foot on me has trod, that's gone from sight and under the sod. I am a rock, but who art thou, painting beneath the restless bough? The painter was shocked at this rude salute, and lay for a moment abashed and mute. She never before had been so near to hear a rock that spoke this mundane sphere. And she felt for a time at a loss to know how to answer a thing so coarse and low, but to give her proof of a nobler sort than the angry look or the keen retort. At length she said in a gentle tone, "Since has happened that you were thrown into this river that's become your home. From beneath this tree as a child I grew, now listening to a stone so hard and new. And so it shall be, this rock that speaks to me. I will cover it with paint, and then we'll see, and quickly adorn thee with the stroke of my brush, its time, its season, its storm, its touch. Not the gentle dew, nor the grinding heel shall ever subdue or make it feel abandoned, unloved, unwanted, alone. For I'll paint this rock and take it home. But soon from this rock she sunk away from the comfortless spot where the pebbles lay. But it was not long before the soil broke, the artist sat once more neath mighty oak. And as she painted and painted, the colors spread. The rock looked up and wondering said, "Modest artist, please I shall never to tell if you covered me in paint this granite shell. See the pride of the river has swallowed me. Won't you pick me up? Won't you set me free? Am I to meekly sink in the darksome earth, never to attain my potential, my worth? And oh, how many more would tread on me while you sit and paint beneath this beautiful tree? Your artistic vision towering towards the sky can transform such a rock worthless as I. Useless, you release me. For centuries here, I'll be sitting in this riverbed from year to year. But never from this shall a complaining word from the painted rock again be heard. For the artist transformed it without and within, gave it new purpose and love again. The rock, its vow she could never forget, it lies brilliantly painted upon her desk, in silence and content, finally at rest. End poem. What do you think, Captain?
That was a brilliant read. That was a brilliant read. You did a great job on
Thank
that.
You. Well, then
this
I
is
made
a
it
wonderful,
easy.
This is a wonderful piece. This is it is it almost reads like a children's story because it has
yes.
it takes a character and takes it through transition, and the rhyming is so smooth and so well done, even when they're not precise precisely on. We're going back to accidents, brush and touch. You know, they're close rhymes, but you've got the short U there, so you've got your assonance, which gives it your rhyme. I really like the storytelling. It's superb. I mean, you get drawn in. You follow this rock through its journey, being picked up by the artist, being retrieved, and she gives it. She gives it color and new meaning, and the rock finds peace with this new purpose and this new skin that it has, this new coat. So it is a really delightful piece, very smooth, very, very well-told story. And like I said, I could see this as a children's book. I really could. I mean, you know, you see the illustrations taking this rock through its journey. This is a beautiful piece.
It would lend itself to some very vivid imagery, I think, if it was illustrated
yes.
well. I do agree with you there. Yeah, I thought it was a sweet story poem, and I definitely agree
yes.
that it could definitely be a children's book. And it just it relates the natural beauty of the setting. And it speaks to me of not underestimating one's worth or the worth of others, even
yes.
an insignificant
yes.
rock.
It has,
and,
it has a moral.
And I think having that moral, exactly,
yeah.
having that moral lends itself even more to a children's book because
yes.
I find from memory there needs to be a reason to the story, something to learn.
Right.
And that's definitely encompassed in this poem. And
very
I think my
so.
Favorite part was I will cover it with paint and then we'll see and quickly adorn thee with the stroke of my brush, its time, its season, its storm, its touch. Not the gentle dew nor the grinding heel shall ever subdue or make it feel abandoned, unloved, unwanted, alone, for I'll paint this rock and take it home. It's just, it's
yes.
very nicely penned,
yes.
But it's a sentimental right as well, which we don't often get on our show.
Usually that's true. You tend to engender the darker side of people, but that goes with the catharsis. Theme.
Yes.
So this is out of Richards, which is the abstract. It is a different tone for us. But truthfully, I think this is a very tender, very gentle, very compassionate piece. It has a story. It has a moral. It speaks of kindness, even to a rock.
Exactly. And just very well done. And I've got you up for the next piece by Thomas B.
I think I can handle it. I've been drinking heavily, so. I used to, when I was working, I used to, how's your day? I said, I think I'm going to go home and drink heavily. If you're looking for me, I'll be under the sofa. under. Okay. Oh, Thomas, yes. He's my neighbor. He has the same area code, and he's about 45 minutes from where I am. We keep threatening to meet.
I know, and you both called at the same time. You both called at the same time when I was learning how to use the studio, and I didn't know how to put people in the green room. So I just had to guess.
And there you were with 2703s being confusing. He does some excellent writes. So let's see what we've got here. We've got in response awesome. To number 70, and that's the prompt is elegy to the Spanish Republic number 70. And I'm looking for a contest, but it doesn't look like it's written to one because it's not on his.
For Richard. It's Thomas doesn't always write for the contest, but it's for Richards, yeah.
But that makes sense because Jackson Pollock used to at one point forsook naming and went to numbering because he felt it was more neutral and tended not to affect the opinions of the viewer. So here we go with response to number 70. Civilization is found. How light deals with darkness, how men define their sense of worth. Death is a business of endings. We find life richer when the alternative sits upon the horizon. Oppression is a wound to the soul, closes the door upon life's magic, leaves a man little chance to rejoice. Light is an expulsion of darkness. Fires once lit can be extinguished, but the light of life once tasted immortal. War, death's campaign, freedom to off death's chariot, yet one can never stop the demand for life to find a way to light. Over the crush of bodies, life is a bird striking for clouds, the silence of the wind haunts. End poem.
Such a great read, and thank you, Thomas, for the poem. I thought this was a profound little brevity that was crafted in response to number 70. And the last two stanzas in particular are both stark and bear the truths of history. War, death's campaign, freedom too oft, death's carrot. Yet one can never stop the demand for life to find a way to light. Over the crush of bodies, life is a bird striking for clouds. The silence of the wind haunts. Indeed it does. And what were your thoughts, Captain?
Deeply philosophical piece. Deeply philosophical. Subtly so. Death is a business of endings. Each stanza is so strong that each one could stand alone. Oppression is a wound to the soul, leaves a man little chance to rejoice. Light is an expulsion of darkness. War, death's campaign, freedom, too oft, death's carrot. That is so clever. And yet one can never stop the demand for life. Life is a bird striking for clouds. That is such a beautiful metaphor. The silence of the wind haunts. The whole thing from start to finish is elegant. Very well-crafted. Very classically crafted metaphor. This is almost, I'm trying to think of, to draw a parallel to someone, almost like Whitman or Frost in the way that it's written. Very matte act, but yet very eloquent in its approach to the truth.
I think war, death, campaign, freedom to off death's carrot is very resonant given the current situation overseas at the moment in Afghanistan.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, look, I'm under no qualms that they were probably not invaded had it not been for their rich natural resources to start off with rather than it just being an altruistic undertaking. But the way in which it was just withdrawn and the Taliban have come in. It's a very sad situation.
It's tragic. It is absolutely tragic. And for my country,
yeah.
was reminded by one of my friends who was also a veteran who saw a service in Vietnam. This is the second time our country has withdrawn in humiliation.
I don't know what the right response would have been, but I think, I don't know, if people had been helping the U.S., maybe they should have been evacuated first, you know?
Now, unfortunately, I think having been alive for both historic times, both were instances of areas where we should not have involved ourselves, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
And who's to say what is the future is going to hold? Because look at now we are we're friends with Vietnam, and who would have imagined it? And there was a time, several decades ago, when we fought with Japan, and now now we're Japan's we're commercially tethered to them, and in Germany, mm-hmm. We import all kinds of technology from them, and Japan. So as the world turns, things change. Who knows? But right now,
exactly.
It is a very dire, a tragic situation. So let's get out of this morass and read something. Bomb! Oh, this has got your name written all over it.
Yeah, I know.
So take it away, Bomber.
I think I'm going to have to take a deep breath for this one. So this is by Stephen New York. I love his writing. And it's dedicated to the forgotten graffiti artists of New York and Philadelphia in the late 1960s and early 1970s, who started all before there were kings. So it goes. They wanted to burn it all, wipe it out, gasoline it. An impulse, the angst-driven lust for freedom told them to combust it, petrify it all in ink, decapitate it in aerosol, batter it all, destroy it, blast it all to their aesthetic hell, slay it in a new cosmos of streak-line and curved beat. New language, more wreckage, youth language, more damage, new ravage, spray damage, maul it, rape it, and murder it all in fresco scrawl. The alternative was their madness. Walls or moving steel right for the marking, districts and tracts for the virgin taking. They felt their birthright to brag a name, scream it in crime, script it like a child's birthday cake. To the eyes of the rich and the poor, in cursive that howled that resurrected a city in color and made her a vibrant Lazarus. Hallmark that could only rise from the tired breath of streets that passed on promises. Well before news and a new style scattered and coded itself across an ocean and Europe was slain. Before the privileged, savvy came and played Bach to the graffiti shock in galleries and commissions. Cling to Chardonnay before kings were made. End poem. And this was written to the prompt, the problems of inventing a new language are staggering. But what else can one do if one needs to express one's feelings precisely, by Robert Motherwell. And Captain, would you like to make the first comment?
Sure. I'm reading the rest of the author's notes. It says, graffiti tribute, remembering the nameless writers from New York City and Philadelphia of the late 60s and early 70s who bombed their names, quote, and bombed in quotes, their names across streets, buses, and trains, and rebirth a movement as old as antiquity of proclaiming one's name to the world well before the form became a commodity and sold for cash. Very well annotated. This is a very dynamic write. It has the power and the force and the impact of bombing, just as I'm sure the author intended. Very punchy. Lines, wipe it out, gasoline it, petrify it all in ink, decapitate it in aerosol. It's a very blast it all to their aesthetic hell, slain in a new cosmos of streak-lined and curved beat. Very eloquent, very colloquial, and appropriately so for the mode of art that this is. And it's strange that we read this because I was I wrote for Richard's contest. I wrote a piece on Jackson Pollock, and in preparing myself for the write, I read about him several pieces on the internet, and I watched the movie, the film Pollock that Ed Harris starred in, and I also watched a documentary. But in seeking out the documentary with Apple, you have viewings underneath, and there were two films on there that I've earmarked for myself, and they're both on bombing, and they look absolutely fascinating, and I can't wait to watch them, especially after this read, because it just seems an intriguing. A rebellious the form of of artwork, and most strangely, and if you think about it though, we're not most of the pioneers of different movements or findings in science. Were they not renegades? The ones who flew in the face of the conventional wisdom and said no, the sun does not revolve around the earth revolves around the sun, and no, the world is not flat. and this is what I'm going to paint with, and I'm going to give it a name and a number instead of a name, and instead of using a brush, I'm going to put my canvas on the floor and paint with a stick. And these are people that just went by their individuality, which is, I think, very courageous. And unfortunately, with the bombers, they tend to use what are considered public structures or edifices or vehicles. And unfortunately, you know, they belong to someone else, and it's considered a vandalism because it's it involves someone else's, because it involves someone else's property. But it is, if you look at some of these, they're quite intricate. They're quite involved. They're not just out there scrolling. This is planned, calculated, designed artwork. And it's brilliant.
And usually on a larger scale, too. Like, I've seen of the newer ones. I think when they say kings, they're referring to probably one of the most well-known ones is Banksy. And they've actually had people remove part of the wall and sell it to a gallery. So it's taken it out of that public scape and been put into the hand of art dealers, effectively. Yeah, yes. I was watching this documentary on Banksy, and some people have actually painted over it because they were sick of the, I think, number one, they had no idea how much it would have added value-wise to their building, but also it attracted so many people that they just didn't want to be part of it, basically. So I think my favorite part here was new language, more wreckage, more damaged youth language, new ravage, spray damage, just... And would we call that assonance?
Yes. That's
I'm
a B2.
Learning.
Professor B2. I learned it from my freshman English teacher, and I never forgot it. Thank you, Mr. Pearlberg, wherever you are.
I learned it. I learned it and then promptly forgot it in my case. So... he's captured the imperative need to create and the need for self-expression for all and not just for those kings. And I think my favorite part, thank you. I think my favorite part was that resurrected a city in color and made her a vibrant Lazarus. That's just such a simple yet effective phrase, I think.
To continue along there, hallmark that could only rise from the tired breaths of streets that passed on promises well before news and a new style scattered and coated itself across an ocean. And if you go to Europe, you see graffiti now, too, more than you used to, because
yeah.
it's translated
wow.
itself across, yeah, across the water. And so this mm-hmm. is this is really a, quite a brilliant piece. It's a social commentary. It's an artistic commentary. And one of the things, and you mentioned removing part of the wall. One of the things I learned and I never thought about it, but it's so obvious that there was the other documentary I watched was had to do with a woman who found a painting in a thrift shop, bought it for $5, took it home, was going to put it in a yard sale, and the local art teacher says, you know, I think that's a Jackson Pollock. And
wow.
that that line became a 10-year odyssey in this woman's life, trying to substantiate that this, in fact, was a Pollock. And one of the things the art community dismissed it out of hand. Her son engaged a forensics, an art forensics specialist. And one of the things and the reason I bring this up is it was allowed to go into Jackson Pollock's studio, which was a 20-by-20 barn on the property where he and Lee lived. And he found a fingerprint on the back of the painting that the woman had purchased. He found another fingerprint on one of the paint cans in the studio, but he was on his hands and knees on a cloth, and he was taking with a scalpel a small sampling of the paint on the floor to analyze the content. And one of the things mm-hmm. I thought was like, that floor, the floor is artwork, because it was the overdrippings of Pollock's work, because he would put his canvas on the floor.
Mm.
And can you imagine what
that
floor is worth? Jackson Pollock's
oh,
floor,
man.
You know? Yeah, but the end result was interesting in that the forensics expert, who was, I think, Dutch, and he engaged a Canadian fingerprint specialist. They found another fingerprint on a painting, a Pollock and the Tate in London, and they analyzed the paint. It was identical, the paint on the painting to the paint on the floor. Forensically, they proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that what she had was, in fact, a Pollock, and yet the art authorities refused to acknowledge it because there's no provenance.
Excellent, Captain. Sorry. Would you be able to read the next call?
Would you like me to do that? Okay. I'm sorry.
Yes,
I wax philosophical here. I'm sorry. I get so wrapped up in these knowledge things. I'm a learning junkie. So thank you for stopping me in mid thought. Hey, midstream. No, please. You know, I will a little truth about me, and I think I've already shared this with someone else. My late partner used to say, because I'm an engineer and I have such a retentive memory, if you ask me what time it is, I'll proceed to explain how to build a Swiss village.
Awesome.
That's me. I give very detailed answers. Poetess Queen, Life Midstream Evolved. And this is another one for Richard's contest. It wiggles its way through womanly birth canals, swimming in groups to implant multiple births, whether twins, triplets, quads, or even quints. Racing, twisting, turning in its mother's womb, striving for life, whether abstractly born or delivered it'll be a life or lives striving for breath-filled lungs as she hums those lullabies while caressing our mound in which we dwell until our time erupts in pain, whether it be false labor or an early birth cascading forth from its placenta in a fluid gush, whether it's a singularity or a multiple birth, life has arrived from a spermatozoa, an ovum meeting midstream, evolved. End of poem.
Fantastic read, Captain. In my pre-commenting, my first comment was, wow. I think it was a great poem. And it was expertly crafted, just on the artistic expression and the artistic process. And I think I was drawn to whether abstractly born or delivered, it'll be a life or lives striving for breath-filled lungs. Now, we all want to create or give birth to a masterpiece in life, I think, but for some it is merely the rumblings of indigestion, so a masterful use of metaphor.
What a wonderful comment. Wonderful. I find the parallel drawn by the author between the birthing of an artwork and actual birth of a living thing, whatever it be. It's interesting, the parallel in the birthing process, because neither one is comfortable. There's no guarantee of the outcome, but it's something that as a woman is driven to deliver the child within her, so an artist is compelled beyond all reason or comprehension to deliver this fixation, this obsession in their heart, in their head, in their soul, to commit to this emotion that forces its way out of them. And I find that an interesting, an interesting parallel. Whether it's a singularity or multiple birth, has arrived from a spermatozoa and an ovum meeting. And in this case, it's the artist and the inspiration meeting. And the outcome is whatever is written or painted or sung or danced, because the artist validates their existence by the act of creation. Just as they say a human validates their existence by the act of creation.
Very well put. Very well put. And we're actually going to get through all of the poetry today, for once. the timing is looking pretty good. So I've got the next one. I've got a poem by Captain Kerr here, and I'm actually going to give this one to you, having a look at it. So it'll be two back-to-back, yeah. But oh, well.
Well, this is one from the art prompt from Once Upon a Midnight Garden. I thought I recognized the artwork. Okay, we have Auric Hues by Captain Kerr. Sunlight teasing blue, avaricious pose, absorbing spectrum, sheer white wild rays, delicious transference, lights the quiet road, my sandals traversing on many days. I hear storming, unsettled, quaking ground, intrusive branches rustled in advance. Startled from behind, I turned suddenly round, enamored by her fleeted passion dance. Silver armored, breast gregarious ribbed, eyes of auric hues, swift determined gait. Posing blue sunlight now battled singed in wind-strewn leaves unresisting in her wake. Neighing leapt with pulse deliriums high, hooved indifference holding me in thrall. I beseeched earthen spirits and poised sky. Orc hues, bear me to my kingdom's fabled hall. End poem.
Very well done, Captain, and thank you, other Captain Kerr, for the poem. So I thought the language in this poem was delectably rich, and I think that Captain Kerr crafted an interesting story laden with imagery. As you would put it, Captain, it was a word picture, and there is a strength to this rite which matches the prompt which was written for Kingfisher, which is the image, I believe, that is at the top of the page there. I think my favorite part was I heard storming, unsettled, quaking ground, intrusive branches rustling in advance, startled from behind. I turned sudden around, enamored by her fleeted passions danced. I think the anticipation is built with energy in this stanza, and it's quite sensory also. And just finally, I'll say it actually reminds me of the never-ending story when the nothing is coming, and you just get that sense of boding almost. What did you think, Captain?
Oh, the language in it is quite colorful. It's a very rich piece, very textured with the language. You've got a lot of subtle sunlight teasing blue avaricious pose, and delicious transparent lights the quiet road. The metaphors in this are just so rich and lively. Silver armored breast, gregarious ribbed, and gregarious is something that is fond of company or sociable. So interesting mm-hmm. adjective use on ribs, but what I like is the title and the use of the word auric through the piece, because the word auric relates to the aura supposedly surrounding a living being, like their chakra. And I find that I think this is a very it gives the verse such a flavor. Eyes of auric hues, swift, determined gait. And then again, auric hues, bear me to my kingdom's fabled hall. Beautiful, just so evocative, there's a lot of sensory stimulation in here. Wind-strewn leaves unresisting in her wake. Determined gait, hooved indifference, holding me in thrall. This is a neighing leap with pulse deliriums high. And the rhyme is so subtle in here. And again, you've got the presence of assonance in here. Very, very subtle. You've got the obvious ones of sky and high, thrall and hall, gate and wake. Now there's another example of assonance. Singed and ribbed. They're not rhyming, but the assonance is there, so which is so delicate, I like this piece. It has a complexity that makes it a very entertaining read.
I think you were spot on about that rhyming scheme, because when I read it the first couple of times, I didn't immediately actually comment on that. That's probably because I missed it. So that's the sign of a good rhyming scheme, as far as I'm concerned.
My ear is tuned to stuff like that. I pick up on stuff that other people don't. I'm the only person I know that looks at ceilings. And I've got a poem in my collection that talks about look at the ceiling.
If we have time, we'll chuck it in on the end.
Okay. It's a very short, it's a brevity. It's a brevity.
That's good. Well, we should have time then, I'd say.
I'll resurrect it, but this attention to detail in here is what attracts my eye. just such wonderful detail on the metaphor. So very fine piece. Really like this, right? Nicely done.
Awesome. Now, while you're digging that up, I will give Gerald E. Green's poem a read. There is a SoundCloud, but I missed it, so I'm just going to give his poem a read. And it goes, it's called Portrait. I watch with envy how my neighbor prospers, his wealth increasing every year while mine remains the same. His woman Prudence died whilst giving birth to their 11th child, and fate, his oldest daughter, now his mother for the family. Some months ago, he added 30 acres from another who, like me, can't seem to make this cursed land produce. But there he is with 7 sons and 14 Belgian horses turning frontier land into a wealthy Pennsylvania farm. I went to school with Prudence when we were both young, in grade school, but felt her too reserved. She blended into her surroundings, acting like she wasn't there. Never at a party did she charm or raise my interest. And yet she grew into a forceful wife with wisdom, guiding from her kitchen, never seen for who she was. No one understood her greatness as a manager, except her sons and husband, who now looked to fate instead. The artist saw and understood, refusing to use canvas, painting Prudence on a piece of wood, reflecting strength and character. I viewed the portrait only yesterday and covered her for who she was, staying in the background, barely seen or recognized. End poem.
Great read. Very nicely done.
Thank you. And
this
was
And again, what a marvel. I like Gerald's work. What a marvel that he has spun this tale of this woman. I mean, we've got Belgian horses in here and a farm in Pennsylvania from this simple picture. At the illustration at the top. I mean, what a rich storytelling with the attention to detail that he's got in here.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's quite a nuanced write, and it's subtle, it's almost as subtle as the prompt. And the story poem that he's created, it's so relatable in the language. It flows well. And it depicts a woman not necessarily seen for her worth, but always present in the background. And my favorite part, I think, was no one understood her greatness as a manager except her sons and husband, who now look to fate instead. The artist saw and understood, refusing to use canvas, painting Prudence on a piece of wood, reflecting strength and character. And she may not have been valued in a multitude of circles, but I think that Gerald has captured the humble nature of Lady Midnight and her knowing gaze.
Yes.
There's almost a pensiveness to her look when you view the painting. And he's captured that in the poem quite well.
And I find this is not just solitary, if you think about it. This is exemplary. Mm. This is illustrative of women of the generation who stood in the back. I've said to husbands who tend to speak ill of their wives. I look at them and I go, does your wife? Okay, you got kids. Okay, she gets the kids bathed, fed, and in bed. She makes dinner. The hot stuff that stuff that's supposed to be hot is hot. The cold stuff that's supposed to be cold is cold. It's all on the table on time. As she does, and she shops. I said, your wife's a project manager.
Yep.
And I said, think about it.
That's it.
I point out to them the delicate balance that she, and she's not doing spreadsheets. This is all in her mind. And this is the same thing with this woman who has these skills, these innate abilities, and yet they are taken for granted. They're just, it's assumed there and they're in the background. It's what I tend to akin this to is like, you know what a 60 cycle hum is? Do you know what a 60-cycle hum is?
You've got
appliances in your home, right? You've got appliances. You've got
the
refrigerator, the television. You've got what? When the power goes out, do you notice the difference in the house?
Yes.
The dead silence, the 60-cycle hum isn't there. And this woman is like, woman is like the 60-cycle hum. She's there all the time. And she's there so pervasively and so consistently that the people in her surroundings become inured to her.
It almost reminds me of the saying, seen but not heard.
Yes, exactly.
Or heard
so.
But not seen in this instance, you know?
Seen but not heard, yeah, which they used to ascribe to children. I made sure I was seen and heard. and all of this from this simple illustration. I did something similar with a piece of artwork that I concocted a similar, a tale also very detailed in its telling, and it was simply a picture of a woman, but I fabricated this whole tale behind it. Of death and that type of thing and visitation, but it's amazing how some chord in this struck him and out came this with names and detail. This is supremely superior storytelling.
Agreed. And now I'll get you to read the next one, which is called The Night Dancer, and I have a feeling, a sneaky suspicion, even though the prompt isn't in the author note, that it's written to the same piece of artwork. So it's
that could be
a completely different spin on it. Yeah.
Leaving the prompt out is known as let's mind fornicate the hosts of the contest. Their heads. Yeah.
Nice way of putting
it. Okay. Haze Sky did The Night Dancer. The Night Dancer, so beautiful, so fair. The Night Dancer appears on clouds of gold smoke. She twirls and she floats. Night is her domain, beautiful yet strange. The creatures her friends protect and defend. When she glides at night, what a pretty sight. Round and round she spins. Hair flying free from pins. Like a swirling, whirling mess, instant relief from all the stress she calls, and she sings as the elves come playing. They gather round, beautiful, proud, and joyous, dancing to the beat of the coming dawn. And when the sun begins to rise, the dancer disappears, much to everyone's despair, for only in the moonlight does she dance, the dancers. Right. And gone.
Now, there's a whimsy to this poem that I really enjoy. And the main protagonist, the Midnight Dancer, provides freedom from the ills of the world, freeing them with dizzying abandon. And I think that prompt, I think I'm actually right, because that last stanza there, the dancer disappears much to everyone's despair, for only in the moonlight does she dance the dancer's night. Just fits so perfectly with that image. Let me just The Midnight, was it Gerald E. Green's poem? There we are. So that was Lady Midnight, I think, by Daniel Bilmes. So I dare say it's written to that prompt as well.
Oh, you are probably right. You have a good eye for these things.
And what were your thoughts, Captain?
I like the visual imagery in this. It has a mythic feeling to it. It struck me reading this that the poems, the word is escaping me, the fantasies of the images that take place at night are either seductive or fantasies, mysterious, or they're demonic. You know, you've got to, the darkness engenders either eroticism or dread or this flight of fancy, which, like a swirling, twirling mess, instant relief from all stress, she calls and she sings as the elves come playing. And you've got these fantastic fairy, you've got fairy glamour, you've got fantasy and illusion. And when the sun comes up, when the sun begins to rise, the dancer disappears, for much to everyone's despair. But only in the moonlight does she dance. And again, in the harsh light of day, your fantasy here, your fairy glamour dissipates, or the dread it dissipates. It retreats, or your romance, your eroticism, tends to wane in the light of day. So it's interesting how those different things with such magic occur at night.
Very good comment.
Very and, philosophical tonight. Stop me before I do it again.
Wow, aren't you?
Okay.
I've got a SoundCloud next. Yeah, let's call it a day because it ain't getting any better than this, is that it? I think we're doing all right, the two of us tonight.
I think so. We all need it.
It's a little bit more work without the callers, but and the inbuilt studio host, but
to paraphrase,
you'd be used to this when I have my days off.
To paraphrase a very famous line from a Humphrey Bogart movie, High Sierra, we don't need no stinking callers. Did I make an obscure reference? Have you seen that movie?
I haven't.
It
was definitely an obscure reference.
There's a scene where bandits come on these three men who are mining for gold, and the bandits want to take what they've excavated. And the bandits identify themselves as federales, and one of the men says, "Well, we want to see your badges." The head bandit says, "Badges? We don't need no stinking badges." And that's actually quite a famous quote from that movie. If you ever get a chance, it's a very well done Walter Huston film, and I watched it as a child, and I had an ending that was very disturbing to me. But watching it as an adult, I could deal with it a lot better. All the gold they dug up, all the gold dust blows away.
Oh no!
So on that little bit, we were back. We are back from tangent land.
I'm gonna line up the next one, which is a SoundCloud by Richard Weissman. It's called Blacker Cloud a Night. So I'll play that now.
Blacker Clouds a Night by Richard Weissman. Shapes in revolution, illumined night-born hazards of her earthbound desolation, splotches, razors-edged, unredeemed as eyes in ascension open wider, swallowing color-formed preceptors bleeding enlightenment, paints back to brain, all extrapolative, unconsciously comprehended retrieval to paint black, revives as form twists, hypocritical, spewing venomous tar mid whitewashed prison sanctus, contends to face-born, one-eyed phantom, oh regal bass music, spews harpsichord rhapsodies onto time-kept reasons as one contends self, he, her, under elastic fortress from blank wizardry, sorcerer in medieval bazaar. Perfection stills the house of wind-torn ruin, black overpaint, one-to-one into self, out of itself, hanging standardless, as Eastern woman dances, reveals to self, raison, tone flooded, infection-born malice revamps, now spreads apart to patterns black-edged, the burnt tan heroin room twists out into ascendancy from wound-split prisons, red-tide cords her neck, twists like butterfly in torment, bizarre to needy unkept anal cavities, proclivities revised, whose palate's brushstroke unvanquished yields these blacker clouds a night. End poem.
Damn, Richard, I will never get sick of your SoundClouds. Now, I had to give this one a read a number of times, and I think it sunk in with each read. And as an overall comment, I thought it was gritty and raw and perfectly abstract, but not without a cohesiveness to the thought. And the lack of colour in the first stanza meant that when it got to this part here, the burnt tan heroin room twists out into ascendancy from womb-split prisons, red tide cords her neck twist like butterfly in torment. It gives it a vividness and a vibrancy, notwithstanding to the darkly rich imagery as well. What were your thoughts, Captain? Captain, are you on mute by chance?
I'm mutating. I get into a verb. Just like a virus, I'm mutating. This is in reference to a specific period in Pollock's career where he, just an aside, the Time magazine article nicknamed Pollock Jack the Dripper, which because he did, he would pour his paint out, but out of a can. And we actually used house paint. But there are a series of paintings he did which were black and white polyptics, they were known. It is a black and white polyptic. Sometimes known as untitled, black poor paintings. They were a bold move away from his color palette. He wanted to emphasize the abstraction, and these pieces were very sooty looking, without the color, with just the stark contrast of the black and white, it made his abstract style even more pronounced. And Richard's piece here really emphasizes that elastic fortress from blank wizardry, sorcerer in medieval bazaar, and then he took one-eyed phantom, old regal bass music, fuse harpsichord rhapsodies onto time-kept reasons, and retrieval to paint black revives as form twists hypocritical, spewing venomous tar mid whitewashed prison sanctus. That in itself, the stark imagery of that, bespeaks of the Pollock pieces during that particular phase. It was either black on white canvas, or black and some red, which I think he makes reference to in his second stanza. So he's really captured the says the patterns black edge, the burnt tan heron room twist out into ascendancy from womb split prisons, red tie cords around her neck twist like butterfly and torment. The visual imagery on it, very stark, very tortured, very vivid, very Richard. Well done.
It was. And now we've moved on to the second component of the night, which is Rex and Pam's poems. And I'll give the next one a read. It's by J.L. McDougall, and it's called The Raven. Lurking in the shadows of a pitch-black night, the raven, underneath the full moonlight, perched out in the branches of the sycamore tree, cloaked in the darkness with his feathered coat of ebony. A messenger of intuition and moral insight, the raven lies in wait. A single call cries out that only you can hear, a warning telling you the raven is near. Its thunderous echoes ringing in your ear like the beating of that telltale heart. The raven can look right through you, straight down into your core, with his all-seeing eye and all-knowing glare, his daggers of conscience ripping flesh from your bones, his bloody bladed beak pecking at your soul, a scavenger of the secrets you've kept rotting there, feeding on your failures and fears. The raven feasts upon your inflictions, dining with the beast that lies within, your guilt, your shame, your sins. He brings your darkness to the light, your burdens nevermore your plight. Those hallowed ghosts shall fade from sight in the wake of truth, transformation and flight. Forever laid to rest your dread, but with the raven's walks the dead, and in your soul he awakens your redemption. End poem.
Oh,
and that
read.
Was written for the raven prompt. And
there's
a little note that it was his twist on The Raven by Edgar Allan Poe. And with that, I'll get you to comment, Captain.
All right. The rhyming scheme is very elegant. It flows very, very rhythmically and evenly and very, very pleasing to the ear and to the read. It's interesting, when a single call cries out only you can hear a warning telling you the raven is near. The raven can look right through you, straight down into your core with its all-seeing eye and all-knowing glare. It's interesting because the raven, because of its black plumage and the way the call is croaking, it's an ill-omened bird, but it's got a symbolism. It's complex because the ravens actually, I believe they can be taught to talk. No, Bocce, not you. That's my cat. I said talk, and he chirped at me. They also represent ravens in stories often present the symbol of prophecy and insight, connecting the material world to the world of spirits. And I believe you find that with Native American lore. So there's different cultural depictions of the raven. And I like the way he is woven those in the daggers of conscience, ripping flesh from the bones, bloody beak, bladed beak. There's your alliteration. peck, and your soul, scavengers of the secrets you've kept rotting there, feeding on your failures. And here, the raven is looked upon as an omen, an ill omen of dread. Brings darkness into your light, your burdens nevermore you plight. And there's the nevermore from Poe's version of the raven, hallowed ghosts. This is, as with the raven as his inspiration, this is a very fine take off of the raven as his particular prompt or inspiration. So this is a nicely done piece.
I agree. I actually picked out both the sections that you mentioned beforehand. And I think the part that goes, a single call cries out that only you can hear, a warning telling you the raven is near.
This resonated with me. It actually reminded me of episodic mental illness. And especially this part here, it's thunderous echoes ringing in your ear like the beating of that telltale heart. But that telltale heart also reminded me of drums beating, you know, reaching a crescendo as his daggers of conscience gripping flesh from your bones, his bloody blade beat pecking at your soul. And as Richard would say, great riffing with Edgar Allan Poe and the picture prompt. So very well done.
I did for last year for Halloween, one of their contests with the Raven, I did a parody on the Raven, and I called it the Budgie.
Yeah. That's awesome.
I think you heard that one, and I used the same meter time scheme that Poe used, it was sporting. It was the Budgie saying nevermore, and other things. I like this rhyme though. This is very skillful.
Well,
yes, very nicely done.
And
okay, what do we got?
And Captain, I think we've got you up next to read Micro's Skull Talk.
Okay, Skull Talk by Micro. And this is another one of I think this is their skull contest. I took one look at that and couldn't come up with a thing. There are some things I just don't find inspirational. It's like looking at plywood.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, okay, I'm going to write it so I'm a plywood. Skull Talk by Micro. Skulls abandoned deep in the dirt like a seashell who listens to bone marrow transmission. Ear to the socket, crashing waves of the past, hearing life's stories, a gift that he had. A needle stuck in a vinyl groove, skulls playing songs into him tuned a reel-to-reel collection stored in the bone marrow. Speaking out from the dead was a book full of stories waiting to be read. They had a good life, 30 years of marriage, albums with pictures packed with trips and adventures, their grandkids and children, all well-respected and all well-to-do. A chance encounter in a flower bed, he pulled out a bone, pushed the soil from the sockets, wiped it down with a handkerchief. He kept it in his pocket. Had a few things in common. Both of them once married the same woman, but that marriage was different, quickly dissolving. And what he discovered tilted his axis, warping his planet. His family from this would never recover. So back under the dirt, he covered him back up. End poem.
Great read, Captain. A bit tongue-in-cheek, a bit serious. I think I enjoyed the macabre twist that was included in the rite. And it was very creative, this idea of resonance through the bone marrow transmission, with the fellow ultimately not being at peace. A needle stuck in a vinyl groove, skulls playing songs into him tuned, a reel-to-reel collection stored in the bone marrow. Speaking out from the dead was a book full of stories waiting to be read. But the second husband, alas, did not want to rock the boat. Now, the skull is presumably buried beneath the ground once more. So in my eyes, he is either recovered once more by husband number three, or there's another unwilling participant. I think that's where the tongue-in-cheek comes in there. So very well done. What were your thoughts, Captain?
This is an intriguing write. Not sure when it opens up, not sure where it's going. But it takes a very macabre turn, a chance encounter in a flower bed. He pulls out a bone, pushed the soil from the sockets, wiping it down with a handkerchief. He kept it in his pocket, which I find strange and macabre. Had a few things in common. Both of them once married the same woman. This is intriguing. I mean, he's created a mystery here that he quite cleverly does not resolve for the reader. He leaves enough information there to tantalize. His family would never, or his family from this would never recover. So back under the dirt, he covered him back up. Him who, why? Why was he under the dirt? What was the involvement of the family? It generates so many questions that this could actually be the, this could be the central topic of an Algonquin roundtable discussion.
You're
familiar with the Algonquin roundtable?
I'm aware of the roundtable, just not the first part.
The Algonquin.
It reminds me of the 12th lawyers. I think it's called the 12th lawyer or something like that. I can't remember. But continue.
Well, there was a group of poets that used to. There's a hotel in New York, and I've actually stayed there, called the Algonquin.
Mm.
And the Algonquin Round was a group of poets that would meet there, and they would discuss poetry and news. I mean, you had Eugene O'Neill, Dorothy Parker, Robert Sherwood, Brock Pemberton. I'm trying to think of some of the other ones. Robert Benchley, who was a humorist and activist. Franklin Fierce Adams, who was a they were all prominent writers that would meet at Algonquin, and they would sit around and they would argue about poetry and literature. And it was I'm looking at the okay, here we go. The group that would become the roundtable began meeting June 1919 as a result of a practical joke carried out by the theatrical press agent, John Peter Toohey. Toohey annoyed the New York Times critic, Alexander Wolcott, for refusing to plug one of Toohey's clients, which is Eugene O'Neill, in his column, organized a luncheon and supposedly to welcome Wolcott back from World War I, where he'd been a correspondent. Instead, Toohey used the occasion to poke fun at Wolcott on a number of fronts. Wolcott's enjoyment of the joke and the success of the event prompted Toohey to suggest that the group attend meetings Algonquin each day for lunch. So that's how it got started. And there were always prominent writers and celebrities that were very they were very articulate and very well read that would meet at this hotel and argue.
Wow.
So that's why I mentioned the Algonquin roundtable, because that's what it sounded like. This would be a topic that would keep them arguing for hours.
Oh, definitely.
That was the reference. That's why I said that, because that's how it struck me. You throw this into the mix, and they'd be arguing until sunup on this one. A very intriguing right. Back to the stimulus of the conversation here. Very intriguing, right? A lot of mystery to it, and a lot of unanswered questions that I believe the author deliberately puts out as an exercise for the reader, which is a very brave and clever thing to do.
It is. And with that, we'll move on to the next poem, Shipwreck of the Selkie, by the Beatnik.
Okay.
And Captain, would you like to give this one a read?
I live for that request. You know I do. Okay. Shipwreck of the Selkie. He looks back at the wreckage from the shallows as he swims ashore, looking desperately for shipmates on the beach, but finds no more. Could he truly be the sole survivor? Blessing or curse, he could not know. He stands waist deep in the surf and remembers the siren call that led them to change course. The sea witches were responsible for the deaths of 31 men, calling out to the lonely sailors to join them for a swim. captain of the Scottish vessel, knew better, but saw a mutiny on his hands. He thought taking the boat in for a look might satisfy the men, but a devil wind shifted and blew the ship directly into the cliffs and smashed the bull upon the rocks, and the ship's hull did split. The men that dove in the water were drowned by the witches. The others were killed by falling masts and fire as the ship began to burn from the flames of the lanterns, spilling onto the deck and below, exploding gunpowder and burning tallow. After the ship sank, it left the figurehead protruding at the water's edge. The story of the Selkie had come to an end. As for the lone Scotsman, he lived off of the island for 3 years before he was rescued by the Royal Navy and returned to Scotland after the Battle of Culloden. And the author's note says that a Selkie in Scottish folklore is a seal that sheds its skin and becomes a human female. The Battle of Culloden between Scotland and Britain took place in 1745. What he doesn't say is, I believe the Scots lost the Battle of Culloden. This is based on a historical reference. So very interesting storytelling here. What did you think?
Well, I love the idea of the Selkie and the Scottish folklore being brought into, I believe this was for the skull prompt. Still, I think there were a few reads for that. And then including a time reference to place the ship prior to the Battle of Culloden, a time when witches were thought to be real and the occult had a great influence on the superstitions of the time, was really quite intriguing. And then you follow on to have one man living to tell the tale through the call of the sirens, though the call of the sirens was quite strong. And then I got a message back from the Beatnik, and he said it was all based on a picture prompt. And I have to admit that I learned of the Battle of Culloden from watching Outlander. And he actually hit Google up to there you go. That's the funny thing, though, isn't it? How creative people are with getting their references. It's not just from a textbook or from Google. It was from Outlander. So I'm thinking I might need to check out me some Outlander.
you've not watched it?
Not yet. I'm not sure which platform with which to watch it on. So I've got to check that out. It's either Foxtel over here or Netflix, one or the other.
Netflix has got it.
It's on my to-do list. Netflix, awesome. Yeah, so I'll have to check that one out because I've got pretty much unlimited time at the moment and I'm running out of shows. So.
And by the way, I have you to thank for binge-watching Lucifer. Thank you very much.
I know. How good is it?
I thought the last line in the series was, oh my me, that one took some thought.
Yeah,
it was intriguing.
I'm still watching it. Would you believe? I think I'm up to season four now, or about to be, but I am. I'm definitely looking forward to finishing that one off. But what did you think of the poem?
Lucifer, you haven't finished yet. Well, I won't ruin it for you then.
No,
don't
spoil alert it.
when I binge watch. I don't fool around. I watch the whole 7 seasons. Standing up. I like this piece. Has a very folktale flavor to it. I liked the mythic quality to it, the fact that he took the Battle of Culloden and put it in here and used it as a pivot point. To where the lone Scotsman was rescued, the figurehead protruding from the water's edge. I love that. And researching the Selkie, it is a very, very Scottish It's actually the origins are Celtic and Norse. It's a mythical being that's capable of shape-shifting, changing from seal to human by shedding the skin. And it's not just female, but males, and it's almost act like an incubus or a succubus, and it's a very intriguing tale for the Scots. They're different from merfolk, because the merfolk just change into humans, but the Selkies are shapeshifters. Interesting. I've been hooked on mythology since I was a kid. So anyway, I like this piece. I like the mythic quality of it. Great storytelling.
Excellent comment there, Captain. And I think we'll have time for one more, and then we might run through the contest that we've got coming up rather than give someone a short comment. So I'll give this one a read. It's by Versus Goliath, No Going Back. She wore death like a tattoo, skin ranged from grey-blue to darkness, complete lack of coloured hue. It made falling in love with her easy, our suffering shared, pain-filled daisies. Bouquet of Rosa Cordisi with white Phalaenopsis orchid to add some height, the clunking in chest from rejection's fright, and how she looked in that amber porch light. Our relationship, eaten by worms, maggots, everyone else ready to see us bag and tag it. Her friends say, I care too much, maybe he's a faggot. Mine say she's cold to the touch, her skin saggy. From within the coffin we share their words with thinner than our air, killing ourselves beautifully all we cared about. Exposed bones from slices on leg. The seeping blood became regular crimson ankles as her coitus begs. Long since got my wings, she soared, sounded heavenly as her echoed, gaspy singing awoke sleeping demons within me. Perhaps the temptations of taboo are what made our actions so foolish. Her sins and lack of penance eased my holy resistances. She ignored my insistence for returns to common sense. Said I was being condescending. Well, this angel certainly saw a descent. No longer sure one can be considered decent. Limbo, where she trapped me, then she left. And Versus made a comment, I know there's a powerful word integrated, but it is based on something that I really experienced, so I can't help that my world is cruel. No hateful intent is behind it from my end. And what were your thoughts, Captain?
Kidding. I'm getting feedback from another country here. I can hear them in the background. Apparently, I'm late with the treats. he's got his agenda. He doesn't mind sharing it with me. This is a very dark rite, very vivid visual imagery, very macabre. It's from the within the coffin, we share their words with thinner than our air, killing ourselves beautifully, we all cared about. The rhyming pattern is very interesting. It's irregular, but it works. He's got maggot, taggot, faggot, and saggy. Again, there's the assonance, because we've got the short A. Taboo and foolish, the long O's, penance, resistance, insistence, and sense. We've got the short E. Her sins and lack of penance eased my holy resistance as she ignored my insistence for returns to common sense. That stanza I really enjoyed. For some strange reason, it really was gripping to me. I was being cunning. This angel certainly saw a descent, no longer sure one can be considered decent. It's really interesting, right? It's one of those things that you kind of have to ponder over, but definitely very dark storytelling, but very intriguing and very engaging, very, very evocative, right?
Yeah, I agree with you there. there's almost a nihilism to the relationship that's described in this piece, but it's not without its beauty. And I found, seriously, with each stanza, it got stronger than the previous one. And
yes.
I literally could have
yes.
chosen each stanza as my favorite. So I couldn't just choose
uh-huh.
one. I actually like this part here. Long since got my wings, she soared, sounded heavenly as her echo gaspy singing awoke sleeping demons within me. Perhaps the temptation of taboo or what made her actions so foolish, her sins and lack of penance eased my holy resistances. She ignored my insistence for returns to common sense. So I think it flowed immensely well. And I just have to say from personal experience, there's something to be said about relationships that fly too close to the sun, almost being attracted mutually to the brokenness in each other. And that level of codependency leaves its mark. And I think that some people just have this innate hold over you until you eventually break free, but some never do.
Yes.
And
yeah.
I think verses pick that up very well in this poem. And we may actually have time to do your poem if you want, Captain. I can talk about the contest in the background. Huh?
Okay. It's A Look for the Ceiling. It's a brevity. And this is kind of my philosophy on life because I am a detail person. To me, the things that are unnoticed, that they go unnoticed by other people, are noticed
mm-hmm.
by me, and they cry out to me. The picture, the illustration accompanying this, is an upward view of the ceiling of the Templo Sagrada Familia in Barcelona,
mm-hmm.
Which is a remarkable ceiling, which is why I included it. So my look for the ceiling. Look for the ceiling. Don't presume that it's there. Look for it. Nothing's to be taken for granted these days. Not friendship, not breathing, not life, nothing. You can wander about till your heart's content if the floor is there. The walls make themselves readily apparent, but never, ever presume you have a ceiling. End poem.
I really enjoyed that, Captain. First, because it almost appears, I'm not sure when did you write this, a year ago? You know what, this could have been written yesterday, I think, with the first part, look for
COVID.
The ceiling, don't presume it's there, look for it, nothing
and
to be taken for granted these days. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, you continue with not friendship, not breathing, not life, nothing. And I think that's really poignant at the moment for me. I think we're up to about day 60 in lockdown. We've got another probably 40 days to go, I'd say, minimum, before we're out of lockdown. And I think we were pretty much, last year, yeah, we had COVID, but we didn't have the variants. And it wasn't really in the community so much. It was more coming back from overseas in quarantine. So it wasn't such a concern. But this time around, I think today, I know it doesn't sound like much compared to what the US has experienced, but for New South Wales alone, I think we had 900 cases today. And that's with everyone in lockdown as well. And
yeah.
That's crazy. Like, it's affecting large components of Sydney.
I think comparing cultures during COVID is like comparing apples and onions. You know, everyone has the cultures react differently. This particular piece was written for a contest by John Levon, and it was complacency in 2020 America. That was the theme of the contest.
Yeah.
So it was written during the time of COVID, people went into COVID thinking quite. They were deluded into thinking that nothing changes. You know, the world goes on from day to day. you know, on and on and on, ad nauseum. And then all of a sudden, the COVID is introduced, and their world is upended, and the complacency, the people that can't adapt, are the ones that are really suffering with this.
Yeah.
Personally, I, having grown up as an only child, learning to entertain myself, the only reason I became aware of the pain of lockdown for some people was by hearing them talk about it. Because to me, that was everyday life. I could spend weeks at a time by myself and not worry about it. I've written several pieces on the gift of solitude for AP, but it's just one of those things that I became aware of it, and that's why I pointed out with complacency. We went into the COVID, what we call the plague of the 21st century, we went into this with a complacency, and all of a sudden we were having to change and readjust our thinking. And that's why, you know, you have to look at these days for the ceiling. You can't take anything for granted. Because I'm still hearing stories about who resist vaccination and in you know, when they're in their death throes with their, you know, with their dying breath, with the death rattle, they ask for the vaccination, but at that point, it's too late.
Too late.
And I'm reading articles about people who are just consumed by. I had COVID last year. I actually got it in December of 19, and did, no one knew what they were looking for at the time. I took several people who went through the same experience I had, where it was first diagnosed as bronchitis, then pneumonia, and it wasn't. It was COVID. Mm. And considering what I'm hearing from my people around me and stories, I'm damn lucky. I lived through it.
Yeah.
I was healthy. I realize every day that I hear about another loss, I look back on what I went through, because I was sick in my house for 4 to 5 weeks before I even went to the hospital.
Wow.
I went to the hospital because I simply couldn't breathe any longer. And that drove me to the hospital, and they put me in oxygen for 3 days, and I was in ICU. But that's, again, the complacency is what I addressed in this. And people take for granted that, you know, life is going to be as it is and nothing changes. And that's to me, every day is a gift. Every day you wake up and are able to step into the shower and greet the morning is a gift. So I said, never presume you have a ceiling, which is my metaphor for don't assume tomorrow is going to come.
Yes. Anywho, I hate to cut you short, but we've got about a minute left.
I've droned on long enough. Stop me before I say anything else.
So for everyone that's listening, if you go to allpoetry.com, and have a look at the contest page on Late Night Poets, you will see all the contests that are current. And thankfully, I've deleted all my old ones, so they are just the current contest. And if you look for Neutron Bomb and Captain B2,
you'll
find our contest there.
Yeah, you're
anyway,
the nag.
We should. Yes, yes, but
so,
that's probably a good thing with me. So I'm receptive to nags.
In the next couple of days, I suspect strongly by tomorrow, once I cull out the herd, we've got enough prompts for two contests. But we're going to have a contest here in the next 48 hours called T-Shirt Wisdom. And it's going to have all manner of T-shirt quotes that people can write to. So I'm not staying with anything famous. In the meantime, we've got our good old Game of Thrones quotes. I think we're up to 11. So and we've got some damn fine poetry in there.
Fantastic. And then we've got Gertrude Bell.
Yes. She was quite the adventurous, quite the pioneer, breaking down barriers, not allowing people to, not allowing society to dictate who she was going to be and what she was going to do. A very courageous woman. So, yeah, we've got that one, too. I'm glad you put that out there. So, anyway, that's what we got, and we're out of time.
Ladies, we are indeed. You have a good night.
You too. Love hanging with you, girlfriend. Tell
me too.
Where do you live? Sydney? Brisbane? Where are you?
Sydney.
Sydney? Well,
yeah.
Tell Sydney that Virginia says hello. Good night.
Good night.